The conference committee will come to order, please. This is the free conference committee on Senate Bill 130. It is Thursday, the...
It's Friday, the 20th.
Or Friday, the 20th?
Thursday.
Of May. The members who are present, Representative Croft, Representative Anderson, Rokeberg, myself, Senator Terrio, Senator Huggins, and Senator French. We have distributed the last conference committee version of the bill that was failed to be adopted on the House floor. We have a packet of amendments that have been drafted to that version. And at this time, I'd like Mr. Lysenki and Mr. Florschinger to come forward, if they would please. I suspect as we work through possible amendments here, we're going to have questions for these gentlemen. And in addition to the packet of amendments that I had distributed a while ago to your offices, no, Representative Croft, we have one from you. Are you anticipating at this time having others duplicated that will be distributed?
Probably conceptual amendments other than that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Representative Rokeberg, do you want to start with one of the particular amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd offer as amendment number one, marked R.5, Bullock 51805, and I'd move amendment number one, sir.
Object.
Okay. There's objection. Purpose of discussion?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, this particular revision deletes section 83, page 52 of the bill, and replaces it with a new section of uncodified law. But what this does, it expands the charge of the Medical Services Review Committee in requiring it to make recommendations for medical procedure guidelines to the task force and not later than December 1st, 05. That's the intention here. This was worked on and recommended by Representative Cott, and we believe in the House that this is a good tune-up because it will require that the task force on, the Medical Service Review Committee would look at national guidelines throughout the country to give them some direction for recommendations to the task force and the legislature to see whether or not some existing or other templates exist to help us contain our medical costs. Plus, it sets a deadline of a date certain rather than the prior version, which merely had the first week of the regular session. So, frankly, I think this is better because it tightens up the delivery of the first report from this group to enable the task force to take it under consideration for their deliberations, for their recommendations to the legislature.
Representative Croft, do you maintain your objection?
No, that's fine.
Is there further objection? Seeing none, amendment number one will be adopted. Representative Rokeberg.
The chairman offers amendment number two, that R.21, Bullock 51905, and I'd move amendment number two.
R1?
It's R21. This is a revision from R4 because we had it on the wrong line. So it's like it's R.21. Do you have one? Janet? Oh, Reef at Ease, Mr. Speaker? Or Mr.
Oh, it's all the way in.
All the way down.
We just need to make a correction on R6.
Okay.
To
what? To 21?
Yeah.
In the packet that the members have, I think if you'll turn to R.4.
Right.
And Representative Rokeberg?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We directed attention to the R.4 revision and moved to line 1. Where it says page 42 lines 19 through 20, it should read page 42 lines 19 through 21. There is one integer off, as all it was.
So if the members will make that reference change on line 1, so
it's a technical correction.
Page 42 lines 19 through 21. And then Representative Rokeberg, if you want to move
yes,
that.
Yes, sir. I move the amendment number 2 as technically corrected. And I'll speak to it if necessary, Mr. Chairman.
Is there's objection?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, This is, again, line 42. My understanding is the intention under the original draft was to try to be as specific in statute as to the inclusionary language of who would be a person. I believe I'm looking myself at page 42 right now, and if you look in the current law on line 19, penalties for fraudulent misleading acts under sub a person, and includes the underlying additional language, including an employee, employer, representative of a person, physician, or a medical provider. Mr. Chairman, as a longtime habitue of the Labor and Commerce Committee for years, this is something that we've discussed numerous times, and under the drafting manual in Alaska law, the term a person is all-inclusive. Therefore, it's a recommendation of the House that we delete that language so as not to appear and cloud the list of people who would be included under the statute. Therefore, by stipulating, we may be ambiguously limiting those people who should be included here. So we think this is a more or less a technical drafting amendment.
The impact of the amendment is to just go back to the current statutory language,
right,
rather than cloud by, say, and start to list including. And if you do that, then did you intentionally leave somebody off that string? If you just go back to the existing statutory language, the person is all-inclusive. Representative Croft.
We might have, by saying including, somebody might read that as limited to,
right,
even though we didn't mean it.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, I don't have any objection to Amendment Number 2.
Senator French, without objection, then Amendment Number 2 will be adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Representative Roepberg.
Chairman, I'd offer as Amendment Number 3 the R.3 Bullock 51805. I'd move that.
There's objection.
It's on page 15, Mr. Chairman. What this does, and I'll try to conceptually describe what this is doing. This specifies that the form that's included in, I believe, the 0.041Q section conforms with this section of the new section of the statute that would, when an individual is going to be either waiving rights for or to receive a lump sum, either has counsel or he has filled out a proper form as approved by the board and submits it to the board for the approval to be able to waive any future rights in consideration for a lump sum payment for retraining benefits. And if Mr. Lisanki could help me out, if I have that correct, it might be helpful for the committee.
Yes, for the record, my name is Paul F. Lisanki. I'm director of the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. That's essentially correct. This was a brought about by a concern that if someone is going to give up their right to a benefit, that the board should prescribe the form and make sure that it includes a full description of what benefits are being given up and the ramifications of doing so. And there is, as Representative Roepberg has noted, there is already a section under Section 041Q that the board exercises the authority to make that kind of a form, and this would be consistent with what they're already doing and make it explicit for the new section G, 041G.
Senator French.
I keep reading these two, and I'm trying to figure out what's different between the language that's in there and the language that we're proposing. I mean, I can see the words are different, but what does it mean?
And I think, didn't we default to and copy the language that appears elsewhere in the statutes?
I think essentially that's what it is.
So it's a matter of style?
I think it may be described, Senator, through the chair as style, but it was a serious concern that some folks felt that the language in the draft, I mean in the bill, just didn't require the board to to prescribe a specific form, and so this does. And
Senator French, if I'm remembering back to the last time that we discussed that, when we came up with the new insert sentence, I think we had a similar debate. Was it a form just provided by the board, or was it a form that the board itself controlled? And so we've clarified, I believe that's just a restatement of language that appears elsewhere in the statutes, where to make it clear that the board, on a form prescribed or approved by the board, so the board controls the form.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think it was very important that there be consistencies in the formats of the documentation, but one of the clear thing in our thinking, I think, was was the fact that the worker, employee that's going to be waiving it, fully understood and was fully appraised of his rights if he didn't have counsel.
Senator French.
On that point, I think it's a good those lines 3 and 4 are a good addition. If we can talk about the next sentence, though. Mr. Lasanki, when you say the notice of election is effective upon service to the administrator and the employer, is that the same as saying the choice is now final?
Through the chair, Senator, I believe that's the intention.
And wouldn't we discussed, and maybe you just said something about that a minute ago, but we discussed having some sort of board approval of that election, since it's such a irrevocable and important decision. Is there any ability for the board to reach down and take a look at that form and make certain that's a good idea for this person to choose one or the other? Or are they just going to have been bound by their choice once they hand the form in?
If I might just have a second to read the other section. It says, through the chair, Senator, it says that the election and waiver of the unchosen benefits is effective upon service to the parties, so it is not actually being reviewed for content.
That's what it says now?
In the bill, through the chair, in the bill, the next...
the next line?
Yeah, further down, the final paragraph of section 18 on page 16 describes the effects of the receipt of the form. And and that section also has some additional requirements that echo it. The earlier section about what must be included by the board in that form, and including that it must conspicuously note the benefit being waived. But it is not being the substance of the decision is not being reviewed at that point.
When we last had this bill in committee, we spent a fair amount of time talking about whether a lawyer should review this decision to make sure it's a really good decision, and the committee decided as a whole that probably wasn't a good idea. We shouldn't inject a lawyer into every single workers' comp case. Nevertheless, this job dislocation benefit is a brand new creature of law. It's never been tried before, and the person that picks that really may be making a terrible, terrible decision. And it just concerns me that we don't have any kind of board review of those decisions. And I wonder if in your discussions you've thought about or talked about having some way to make certain that the board take a look at those decisions and review it just for basic fairness, to make sure the person isn't, so to speak, giving away the farm on an injury that they could do a lot better on if they were to take, say, the reemployment benefit.
Through the chair, Senator. I think what prevailed in the discussion was that right now reemployment benefits do not have to be approved, and the legislature went to some efforts in 2000 to reiterate that since this is a voluntary choice, this particular benefit of the employee, that they don't even have to ask for it, that they underscored that you can waive it, explicitly waive it, without any further review of the board. So I think that was the track that this followed.
And I guess my last point on that would be, that's fine. If in this election a person picks reemployment, that's fine. We've been operating that way for 30, 40 years, and so there's no disruption to the system. But the job dislocation benefit that has some dollar values assigned to a percentage of impairment there on lines 26 through 31, we don't know if those are really good values or not. They're just values we've assigned. And so maybe we could only have the board review those elections that elect the dislocation benefit, because that's where we may be stumbling into a new area of law that doesn't serve workers very well. I guess I'm proposing a conceptual amendment.
Okay, first of all, Representative Croft, you had a, did you have a question on this point?
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it'll lead in the same direction, but put on the record by way of apology, all of you have seen this in various committees. It didn't go to finance until it was sort of quickly considered there, and so I'm catching up to some extent. The board has the power under this amendment and this section to prescribe the form where an employee waives these rights, but has no ability to take a look at whether the individual decision to do that is in the employee's best interest?
Representative Croft, through the chair, that's correct.
And I thought a fundamental principle of the workers' compensation system was that you're often getting people who are just injured workers and they don't know how, is that true of a lot of other medical benefits, wages, lost that the board doesn't have the ability to say this might not be a good idea for you?
Representative Croft, through the chair, no, this is specific to vocational, what we would normally refer to in lay language as vocational rehabilitation benefits and is referred to as reemployment benefits under our act.
If I want to wait,
pardon me, that, and I just finish and I'll let you follow up. And that's been something that's been consistent ever since the reemployment benefits were invoked, amended into the act in 1988.
I want to waive future wages. I need board approval.
If you, through the chair, if you want to waive your right to a benefit other than vocational rehabilitation,
need board approval.
You need board approval, although that would be limited somewhat under the bill.
Am I right about that's what the purpose of board approval is that we've got a system where we've got people who are doing their job injured, not lawyers themselves, and we want to make sure it's in their best interest before they waive something that might be important to them.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I believe that's the intention, and that's the specific standard under Section 012.
Back to him.
Okay, Senator French.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm proposing an amendment to the amendment that would read something like this: an election of job dislocation benefits shall be reviewed by the board to determine whether that election is in the employee's best interests. And just by, and parenthetically, I just say that you could run under this regime or run under this statute for some time and see whether these are good elections. Because this is a brand new provision of law. Because we don't know whether $5,000 is a fair value for a permanent partial impairment between 0 and 15%, or $8,000 is a fair value between 15% and 30%, and so forth. And so I think that an unrepresented employee making that election, a permanent election for a job dislocation benefit, there should be some supervision of that election. And I think that the board's the perfect person, the perfect entity to make that decision. And it may be that it's a fair election, but I think it'd be good for Alaskan workers to make certain it's a wise selection.
I'm going to object to the amendment. Is there further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look at this, I was trying to think of different hypotheticals. Perhaps, and Paul can correct me if I'm wrong, an analogy would be that this would apply to a bricklayer who injures his back and then is afforded retraining because he says, I can't lay bricks any further, but I maybe could go to computer school and be a computer tech. And then he would be afforded retraining, and the costs would be covered. Or he could say, no, instead I'll take a lump sum. Is that an analogy of or a hypothetical of what might happen?
Representative Anderson, I think that's accurate under the existing statute, which would be changed somewhat by the bill.
And then through the chair, the change would say, okay, I think that this amendment is good for the employee, the injured, because it says, wait a minute, think long and hard. You're under oath, and we know that the board is providing the amendment. And I think the fact, standing alone, that there's an oath, and I think that lends seriousness to the signing of this document, fulfills what Senator French is suggesting. And I think I respectfully disagree with you, that if you have the board review every time someone chooses this in their best interest, it may be it may delay, and maybe they need the money for other reasonable reasons or purposes. And also, if they disapprove and reject that, what if the person did need the lump sum for another reason? I think we may be meddling. I mean, I look at the permanent fund dividend. At the very end, it says, do you want to have part of this or all of this or a portion of this go to, college scholarships and some other things? And I don't think people have to be lectured or advised on that. And I'm sure there's people with low IQs that fill it out and others that don't. But we don't insert oversight over that. We let them choose on their own. This is obviously more important, but I don't think we need to go that far.
Representative Roper.
Through the chair, Mr. Lasanki, could you just refresh my memory on how the division works on certifying, training, or educational programs? Can someone, does someone have to go to a program that's approved by the board or your department, or can they submit a alternate program for approval?
Through the chair, Representative Rookberg, if I understand you correctly, for purposes of retraining, is it limited? The answer right now is no. We are not in the business of specifically certifying any retraining plan as a. What happens is someone who exercises their right to the benefit works in conjunction with an assigned vocational rehabilitation counselor. And with the assistance of that counselor, they come up with a plan for retraining that person. And then the parties are free to agree to that plan, in which case it happens. Or either party is free to object to the plan and ask one of our staffers, the Reemployment Benefits Administrator, to make the call as to whether it's a reasonable plan or not. But we do not certify retraining plans per se.
If I could follow up and forgive me for my remedial education here. What if the Representative Anderson's bricklayer wanted to go to a culinary chef school and the counselor thought that would be too arduous given the nature of his condition? And I think one of the purposes here would be that the employee there then could waive his rights and take the lump sum and go to the chef school. Would that fit that kind of a fact pattern, or what? You know, I mean, there's any number of reasons somebody might want to waive their right and take the money, but.
Through the chair, Representative Roper, that's essentially true, although under the bill, they would be somewhat limited in a way that they're not now.
You want to elucidate on that?
Right now, you can disagree with what the proposed plan is and ask to try and settle your case for what you think the alternative value of that plan is. What this would do is say, well, you have to elect the benefit, and if you choose not to elect the benefit without even getting that far, without even getting into the planning process for whatever reason, then you would get this alternative job dislocation benefit. It wouldn't be tied to the specific value of what you wanted to do. So I assume that you would be making the
The mental calculus would be, if I choose retraining plan, I can work with this person and pursue it, or I can choose not to seek retraining for whatever reason, because I think I can go back to some other job that I know how to do, because I disagree with the projection that I can't go back to the job I'm currently doing. There could be a number of reasons why you would come to the conclusion that you don't want to pursue retraining benefit and then take the job dislocation benefit as you waived the benefit you didn't want. It's not supposed to be dollar for dollar what you could have gotten under retraining.
Representative Roper.
Just to follow up, I think one of the ideas here behind the original proposal is to decrease the workload of the board, you know, to have the board review every waiver. You know, seems just almost ministerial if in fact that the information on the form or whatever assistance may or may not have been given to the applicant or employee, we're going to trust him to make the decision, or we're going to have to make the board under Senator Hollis's Senator French's amendment, then we're putting more administrative burden back on the board. So.
Representative Croft.
We're done.
Yeah.
I think Representative Anderson's point is exactly the problem. He said, you got somebody injured on the job, and what if they need the money? They do need the money. They're not at work anymore. They got families to feed, and to say, we want to encourage retraining people. We want to get that person not just off the list here, but onto working as a computer programmer or a culinary chef or whatever it is that they can do next when they can't do what they used to do before. And this is within 30 days of notification of eligibility for benefits. You're at home injured and you get this form and it says you can get you're 50% disabled, we think. You can get $13,000 right now. Just sign this form. You got bills to pay. Yeah, you're off, and medical bills are stacking up. They might pay for them, they might not. You think they are, but they're still stacking up. And the problem is there's a lot of people who should be retrained and rehired, who we can get in the workforce, who will take this and pay their bills and then have no new job, no new skills, just be sitting there at home 50% disabled. If you allow, I mean, we with this, now they're signing it under oath. They can get accused of perjury if they come back and said, I know I signed and said I'd read the whole thing and all that, but I really didn't read it. I didn't know, and I do want to get retrained. Now you can't even come in and say that. I made a big mistake. I was, you know, I'm 50% injured. I'm on pain medication. I got that form, and I saw the $13,000, and I really didn't read the rest of it. Well, you signed under penalty of perjury that you had. So they can't come back. They can't get retrained, and the $13,000 went for the bills that they had. And it may be, it's what we have the board there for, is because sometimes these waivers that look good when they say, hey, you're completely disabled, you're never going to work again, we'll give you $50,000 now, it can sound good to a desperate employee, and it's not a good idea. And this isn't either. And we ought to have some oversight by the board so that people are not put in this sort of hospital situation over and over and over. It's an appropriate protection. Part of the trade-off of workers' comp is you don't get full compensation for your injuries, but you get it hopefully quicker and with more protections, a process that tries to protect you. This is taking out another protection, and we shouldn't. And by capping these, anything over 30% disabled, it's a $13,500. 80% disabled, $13,000. I'm worried that you're going to have desperate, injured workers taking that election, and we've just shipped them on out. We don't have to consider it again, and we're not going to be getting them back in the workforce as we should.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks. Just briefly, and the converse to what Representative Croft said is that, using Representative Roper's hypothetical, the person says, I want to be retrained. Let's say I injured myself in bricklaying as a bricklayer, hurt my back. I want to be retrained as a window washer. Lots of money in that. And it is determined if Senator French's amendment to the amendment passes, it is determined by the workers' comp board, wait a minute, that could exacerbate your injury. We're sorry, we can't let you go for that training. One, how would the person appeal that? Two, if the person says, well, I don't agree with your paradigm of where I should be retrained, I want my lump sum money, and the workers, the board comes back and says, we're sorry, in your best interest, we don't think we should give you the lump sum money. One, what's his recourse? Two, is that fair? And three, every time you renew your car insurance, again, the permanent fund dividend, go get a prescription. You know, there's the long thing, okay, this could happen if you take this the wrong way. People don't always read that, and we don't force them to, and we don't force oversight. And I think there has to be accountability. And it would, I think Representative Roperick is dead on that it's cumbersome. And the point of this bill is to reduce some of those cumbersome things while protecting the employer, but giving them the ability to choose. And I think that it's too watchful to have the worker board come in then after the fact. And how would you appeal it?
Senator French, do you have a wrap-up?
I'll just remind the members of the panel that this is a brand new creation in state law. We've never had a job dislocation benefit ever in Alaska state law, and I'm very concerned that the dollar values aren't set right and that the decisions made have profound and long-lasting implications. And so I think board oversight will benefit both sides, both the society that expects individuals to work for a living and to be productive members, and the individual who is making a seriously important election.
If there's no further debate, we'll call the roll call on Senator French's amendment to the amendment.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Roper?
No.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Tarrant?
No. So the amendment to the amendment fails, which brings us back to amendment number 3. Is there further objection to amendment number 3? Seeing none, amendment number 3 will be adopted. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, we have before us amendment R.2, Bullock 51805. I'd mark that as amendment number 4.
Which one? I'm sorry, 5.
It's R.2, the palliative care. And I would move amendment number 4, Mr. Chairman.
Object.
There's objection. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, this replaces the language that was in the conference committee substitute on starting on page 23. Let's see if I can get there too. This the first portion just deletes the entire section 32 of the conference committee report, therefore defaulting back to statutory language between lines 2 and 21 that remains in the law. That's replaced by assertions on page 25 that adds the sections and lines 12 through 22 on the first page of the amendment. And what that does fundamentally, Mr. Chairman, is indicate that the palliative care comes into play after the date of medical stability is determined and is allowable for the provisions subsection 1 and 2 on 14 and 15 that enable the employee to continue in the employment at the time of treatment and to enable the employee to continue to participate in a approved reemployment plan. Or, now we've used the disjunctive word or and created a subsection 3 to relieve chronic debilitating pain. In the prior iteration in the conference committee committee substitute, there was a cutoff there and concern in particularly in the House that we had debated the impacts of having the language as a standalone sentence. If you refer back to page 23 in lines 27 through 29, that that may give rise to other difficulties in the fact that that particular limitation would be entirely discretionary and part of the attending physician, and there would be no recourse to controvert it by the employer. So the amendment clearly indicates this particular type of care is to be administered through the board, and there can be action to controvert it by the employer there. Additionally, to avoid confusion as to what the impacts were, I'd refer the members of the committee to the second page of the amendment. That is to say, in subsection 36 added, the definition of chronic debilitating pain is added, following in the main definitions from medical dictionaries. I believe I was shown a copy of Mosby's. And then further on the amendment, on line 11, the definition of palliative care is also provided to help avoid any ambiguity as to what this does. Mr. Chairman, this, I think, in the main overcomes substantial debate and some objections on the House floor as to the potentiality of giving rise to additional cause of action and unlimited palliative care being dispensed by any attending physician. This narrows it substantially and I believe solves many of the questions.
Okay, just so members understand then, so the language on page 23 of the existing version, we're just dropping out the added language there, which...
Sorry, I hate to interrupt, but it says, the amendment says lines 1 through 29, delete all material.
Right, so it's basically dropping out 32, which would retain the current statutory language, and instead of having it added onto that section of the existing statute, we're creating a new section, and then we have two sections of definition that go along with the new section. So just to speak to the form, is the objection to the amendment maintained?
Yeah.
Representative Croft?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's some concerns about the new subsection, but it's mainly in the definitions. So definitions of chronic pain and the definition of palliative care. Maybe I can start with the palliative care one. On line 12 of page 2, starts on line 11, but then line 12 continues on line 12. Palliative care means medical care treatment rendered to reduce or moderate temporarily the intensity of an otherwise stable medical condition. And we were having the discussion when we got the amendments an hour or so ago about how you moderate the intensity of a medical condition. All the discussion I've heard on palliative care has been directed to pain, and it's hard to evaluate and wait. I'd propose, and so that we can discuss it some, between of and. So what the intensity of, right after intensity of pain caused by an otherwise stable medical condition. And so I'd move that as an amendment.
I'll object for discussion.
The concern.
So, state it again.
Yeah.
Suggest in between the word of and, pain caused by?
Right. So the sentence on 12, or the portion of the sentence, reduce or moderate temporarily the intensity of pain caused by an otherwise stable medical condition.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. To my objection, I would ask Mr. Lisinski, isn't this similar to some of the other amendment language and verbiage, isn't this taken from the Oregon statute, this definition, palliative care?
Representative Anderson, through the chair, the definition of palliative care is indeed taken from the Oregon statute.
And through the chair, this added pain caused by isn't in the, I mean, not that Oregon's the measure, but I just, we'd be changing our palliative care definition so it's not similar to, identical to Oregon's.
Through the chair, that's correct. Any changes to this definition would be a departure from the definition in Oregon.
Representative Roper.
Through the chair, whoever wishes to answer that, either Mr. Flushing or Mr. Lisanki, I have a significant concern about this amendment to the amendment because it actually limits the scope of what the definition does. And I, frankly, I think it's too limiting. There's other prognoses or medical conditions that may give rise to the need for palliative care besides pain. I mean, I have the old stiff knee syndrome or other things that may require some ongoing care that can't be curative, but could only be palliative. So I'm sure there's medical conditions that might be applicable under this broader definition. Therefore, I'd certainly speak against the limitation of pain only, and I'd like to have Mr. Florschinger or Mr. Lasanki speak to that.
Someone, I'd like to talk about my amendment to the amendment. It went straight to the objections, and whenever you want, I'd like to say why I think it's a good idea before we get too far down why everyone thinks it's a bad idea.
I'll defer to the member from Spinard in due respect, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Croft.
Jumped in there. It's exactly my concern about, because what we're doing by the definition, once it's palliative care, it has these restrictions in the first part of the amendment. Once you define it as palliative care, then you can only do it under these three situations. We're talking about various examples. The Christopher Reeves example was the one that made the most sense to me. He's a quadriplegic, was, and is not going to get better. It's a stable medical condition. I don't know whether he's in significant amount of pain, but even if he wasn't, there are things that you have to do to make just his life better, you know, move him in bed, put various ointments so that he doesn't get sores. You do things, the wheelchair itself, there was a lot of discussion. You say, well, is that making your condition better? No, it's not affecting my condition at all. It's just so I can get around. It's so I can exist. A prosthesis was suggested as, well, is that improving your condition? It's not affecting my condition at all. It's improving my life. And all the discussion I'd heard that was worrisome, the concerns I'd heard, let me put it that way, was that, well, it's pain. It's hard to tell pain. Treatment just for pain. I can understand that, and it's the very reason I want to limit palliative care and the restrictions we place on palliative care to that very difficult-to-measure pain area. But don't keep it so broad, and therefore your limitations on what they can recover, that you can't get a wheelchair. We had discussions about a diabetic. Is that condition getting better? No, but the insulin should be covered. It's a medically stable condition, and it, you know, when you say the danger of the definition now is that it then allows these limits, and you say, well, Mr. Reeves, are you going to do, or if he was not in chronic debilitating pain, back to that first section, and I don't know whether he was, is this treatment of moving you around in bed and things going to help you go back to work? I'm not going back to work. Is it going to help you on a reemployment benefit? I'm not going to be reemployed. I'm going to be in bed. Are you in chronic debilitating pain? No. Then sorry, it's palliative care, and we don't cover it. If you keep this definition of palliative care the way you have it, we may be wiping out whole classes of things that help people live with their workplace injuries. Now, I agree we need to have a discussion about pain, but I hope we don't accidentally do in this second conference committee things that hurt whole areas that we don't know about. Thank you for letting me describe that.
Representative Croft, the issue you brought up, the wheelchair, and I'm not sure that under the diagnose, heal, or permanently alleviate, if a person's lost the ability to walk, it would seem like that's the wheelchair. It's covered under permanently alleviate the condition. So I don't think that would be swept in under
It doesn't alleviate a medical condition. I mean, the medical condition exists. You say, is this going to help you get use of your legs? No. It's not going to diagnose, to heal, or permanently, or even temporarily alleviate the medical condition. It'll alleviate my suffering. It'll make my life better. But it doesn't have, I mean, a doctor's going to have to come in and say, no, I want him to get that, but I'm afraid it does not affect his medical condition one iota. He's going to be paralyzed whether you do this or not. I apologize for that.
Okay, and you've used the word pain there, but we had the example of, well, what if you just have sort of the limitation of a range of motion? It might not be, you know, pain, but have you proposed language here that is tighter than really the things that are going to be faced out there? I mean, you've got pain is the only thing that gets swept in under here, but there could be other things, it seems like, that lend themselves to palliative care treatment.
He's saying you're limiting, I mean, they kind of agree with you.
Well, it's kind of tricky because you're limiting one section so you don't limit your remedies on the other. the broader the definition of palliative care, the more things that, then if it's palliative care, and if this whole area is palliative care, then you can only get it for these three reasons. If it's not palliative care, you can get it for other reasons. And therefore, the tighter you make palliative care, the more you leave out into the general ability to be part of the compensation system. So it is kind of tricky, but that's right, Mr. Chairman, because there are a lot of other things outside of pain, and I don't want them limited by this first section of the amendment. I want the discussion, at least that I've heard, has been people come in and allege a bunch of pain, and what do we do about it? And similar treatment for pain, giving them pills or giving them massages or whatever for pain, we're worried about either from a suspected fraud level or just it's so hard to measure. And so, great, if we've said palliative, but the examples have been pain. And so if we mean it, let's make the definition pain, and then these become much more appropriate. We already talk about chronic debilitating pain in the palliative area. Then it's a lot more defensible what we're limiting.
Senator French.
I'm listening to your Senator Terrio's concern. It strikes me that what Representative Croft is saying is that if you're having a problem with your range of motion, there's some other portion of the workers' comp statute that's going to take care of that. It's not palliative care. Is that right, Mr. Lysenki? If you need some help reestablishing your range of motion to go back to work as a shelf stalker at Cars, it's not palliative care that's going to fix that range of motion problem. It's some other provision of the workers' comp statute.
Through the chair. Senator French, I think you're right. Essentially what, in your scenario, I think that what it would represent is additional medical treatment that would objectively improve your condition, and therefore you would not yet be medically stable. And it's the onset of medical stability that makes the difference under this provision.
Senator French, I realized through the discussion that my example probably was not the best one, that it probably is covered elsewhere. Senator, Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask the department about this. It may help clear up something that, like the definition of medical stability and how that would play into these various scenarios. We're trying to sit here and walk through these different maladies that people suffer, and clearly, I don't think any one of us up here want to restrict proper treatment to anybody. That's not the case. I mean, so we want to make sure we get it right. But if we could have, I think, a little better clarity about what constitutes medical stability and how the third section here, when you're not working or you're not being retrained and you are not able to return to work, and you must have then pain to qualify for this care. How does this work? It seems to me that the medical stability is the touchstone here. And if somebody has a problem that they can be unclassified as medically stable and qualify for treatment, would that be correct?
Through the chair, Representative Rochberg, although I'd say probably, I don't know if most is a dangerous word to use, but a lot of cases, or many cases, you have an injury, you get the necessary medical and health-related treatment to improve your injury as much as it's going to improve, and at that point, you're essentially medically stable. Because medical stability turns in terms of its definition in our statute, as whether or not there is a...
And where's that definition? I'm sorry.
It's AS 2333-9521, Senator, through the chair. If you've got the green book, it's page 102 onto 103.
I lost my green book.
Okay. And it turns on the whether there is a reasonable expectation that additional medical care or treatment will objectively improve your condition. So treatment continues in essentially, to put it in lay language, treatment continues until there is no reason to expect that additional medical treatment is going to improve your condition, so you're stable. That would be the trigger for under the bill and under this amendment for starting to look at treatment which is palliative in nature, which can make your symptoms better but cannot, by definition, improve your condition.
And up to that point, everything before that point is curative treatment. Is that correct?
Ms. Senator Terrio, yes. That's so, essentially the...
So you go as far as you can with the curative treatment, and that's self-explanatory. I mean, it's to cure the underlying problem, the injury.
To make you better, to make that condition less bad.
Okay, and once you have done that, you've gone to the end of that curative, the palliative is what's beyond that. You're no longer curing the condition or injury. That's been done under curative care.
Senator Terrio, that's essentially correct. The medical care has gotten you as back to healthy as you're going to get, presumably. And then palliative care could still, for example, relieve pain, as Representative Croft has brought up, or perhaps some other things, whether it's range of motion or the other things that you're positive. But it's not going to make the underlying condition improve.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Senator Terrio. And so to that end, Mr. Lisinski, then you use someone on the committee used the example of range of motion. I've been injured, so my range of motion isn't as far as I'd like it to be, and it limits me to do things. But temporarily, I can expand that range of motion, let's say through therapeutic massage of the arm. But if this amendment to the amendment passes, wait a minute, my range of motion doesn't work, but there's no pain accompanied with it. It's just the intensity of that. And because if this amendment to the amendment passes, because there's no pain caused by it, I won't receive that therapeutic massage. Is that, I mean, if the amendment passes and that...
Representative Anderson, through the chair, I think you've summed it up pretty aptly. I mean, maybe that's maybe something that a layman like myself might refer to as stiffness,
sure,
as opposed to pain.
And if you add in pain caused by, then you wouldn't be able to. So to me, that hurts the worker, and I would say I would have to reject the amendment to the amendment because it's more expansive just using intensity as a measure.
We have further discussion on the amendment to the amendment. We'll have a roll call vote.
Yes.
No.
No.
Yes.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Terrio?
No. The amendment to the amendment fails to pass. Brings us back to amendment number 4. Is there objection? Yeah. Senator French.
One more question for Mr. Lisinski. Mr. Lisinski, how long has this definition been in Oregon law? How long have they been operating under this definition?
Senator French, through the chair, I have to apologize. I don't know precisely. I do have a copy of the Oregon statute with me, so if we have a break at some point, I'd be glad to take a look at it and see if it's noted.
I mean, I know they've worked over their workers' comp statutes not too long ago, and so I'm curious whether this is part of a recent reform there, whether it's been in existence for 40 years, and there's, you know, a body of case law. I guess that's an important fact for me to know before I decide whether to adopt this in Alaska law. So maybe we can take a five-minute break, or...
Well, can we ask Mr. Florsinger if he wants
to... I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Dave Florsinger. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. I believe, but we can confirm it, I think it is approximately 1990, I think.
We were looking at another amendment, whether it's offered now or not on the major contributing cause, and I know that's been a debate. That's been around almost 10 years, my research showed, in Oregon. So I think this is over a decade, these.
Further questions on amendment number 4?
Chairman, I would like to clear up one thing on the record. Using the CRISPR Reeves type scenario, and I just want to make sure that we're not going to make an error here. When you get into that kind of a situation where there's a chronic medical condition but may not give rise to pain, what happens there, and how is that benefit going to be made to that patient, that employee that was clearly job-related problem under this under this amendment? Or doesn't it apply? I mean.
Mr. Lisinski?
Representative Roper, through the chair. That's a very good question. The definition is broader than just pain. So I think it is a good question to inquire about exactly how it would apply to someone in that situation.
Well, the question is if you look at page 1, line 16 in the subsection 3, we have the three, that's the third element of a three-stage test for qualifying for palliative care. And the situation here, we have a long-term disability. Would workers' comp benefits flow through that person if they didn't? Clearly, it wouldn't apply to the first two cases, but unless there was a provable pain, and then even though there was, you know, 45 days of no change, then you got a rebuttably presumed position of medical stability. So what do we do about this person?
Through the chair, I think that that's a valid point, that if you take that as the worst-case scenario and you only have these three and there is it is not causing chronic debilitating pain, then it may not qualify for further care, something that's, you know, palliative in nature.
Well, is there a way we can expand the sub three? We just had this little mini debate about issues that besides pain, and then we have the definition of palliative care. Is there I don't think I would object to broadening sub three to the point where it would fit those without being abused. I mean, that's one of these balancing acts we're trying to do here. Try to find something there. I mean, I just kind of, I'm concerned about that, and I don't want to be able to, I don't want to be denying benefits to someone that justifiably deserves them. On the other hand, we know that this is subject to significant abuse.
How do we know that?
A priori. So.
Why don't, no, I just need to take a quick bathroom break, so why don't we take a break at this point? Encourage people to get a drink if they need to, and if you have to have some conversation here on this point, why don't we do that at this point? Thanks. We'll take it at ease.
The most important pride.
The committee would come back to order, please. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, in light of the testimony, I want to make a motion to rescind our act in not adopting the amendment to amendment number 4 that related to the assertion of the word pain on line 12, page 2 of amendment number 4.
There's a motion to rescind our action in not adopting the amendment to the amendment number 4. Is there objection? Seeing none, that means the amendment to the amendment is back before us. It is to add on page 2 of amendment number 4, page 2, line 12, after the word of, pain caused by. So those three words would be added. Is there objection to the amendment to the amendment?
Is that pain caused by? Excuse me.
Pain caused by is what I said, yeah. So
was it pain caused by? I'm sorry, I didn't have that.
Intensity of pain, otherwise it'd be intensity of pain and otherwise stable medical condition.
Caused by, okay. I didn't have that.
So is there objection to the amendment to the amendment? Seeing none. The amendment to the amendment will be adopted.
So I ask whether Representative Croft gets extra points for bringing the whole committee back around.
Okay, that brings the amended amendment number 4 back before us. Is there objection to the amended amendment?
I object. One provision better, but it's still got a lot of other bad provisions in amendment number 4, that is.
The objection to amendment number 4 is maintained. Is there any further debate? Seeing none, we'll call a question on amendment number 4.
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Croft?
No.
Representative, Senator Huggins?
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Mayor Terrio?
Yes. Amendment number four, as amended, has passed. Let's see, at this point, why don't we, Representative Croft, take up your amendment?
Sure, okay.
We will label that amendment number five.
It's partially conceptual. I have it down here, obviously, but I'd propose that we eliminate the appeals commission and put this language in its place. So partially written, partially conceptual.
Okay, I will object to the amendment. Would you like
for discussion or like a real objection?
For a real objection, so if you want to discuss, please.
The appeals commission, we'll talk more about it probably when we move the bill, but very expensive, and the primary justification for it is that there is this allegation that there are conflicting Superior Court or board decisions. I've never had that proven to me, and Senator French has been asking for that documentation for a while. I've never seen the possible conflicts. To the extent they are, this provision would allow the commissioner of the Department of Labor or any person who has a work comp case to say, we have a case and these two decisions look in conflict to us, please tell us the right rule of law. Our current system goes to the Supreme Court and they come down and they say either they're not in conflict or they are and here's the decision that you ought to apply. I think we're chasing around, chasing our tail here, that we're chasing a false deal. I don't think this is a significant problem out there. But if it is, let's put a procedure in to fix it. The current proposal puts in a bunch of political appointees, costs a tremendous amount of money, adds a layer of bureaucracy, all for justifications that that haven't been proven to me. So let's use our current system, and to the extent there are conflicting workers' comp Superior Court decision, let's have them reconciled by the right tribunal.
In essence, you're asking the Supreme Court to make sort of pick and choose between the different opinions, give advisory opinions almost.
But there's various ways that happens now. You can certify questions of state law back to the state court. So a federal court could be sitting in the Ninth Circuit down in San Francisco and say, this turns on how Alaska law would do it, and we don't really know. The parties disagree, and they certify a question over to the Alaska Supreme Court, who says, our law is this. And that helps the federal court go on with its stuff. There's precedent for doing these kinds of things. And certainly if you have if you're a litigant and you see conflicting cases, doing it, it is very, I feel very, that's fine. The one I added, and the one that has the most sort of, well, they don't have a case or controversy, is the Commissioner of Labor. I want the Commissioner of Labor to be able to, on behalf of the state, say, we think there are conflicting opinions here. That, to your point, Mr. Chairman, that gets to the most advisory of them, where you actually have litigants in a actual comp decision. I think the precedent is there. It's the other that makes it a little, which is a little bit of a different twist, if you will. But this governor said that that's part of his concern, and if the Commissioner of Labor wants to clean up workers' comp law because he's got conflicting decisions, he ought to have a process to do that.
Okay. And Representative Croft, I'm sorry, is part of this, though, then to delete the appeals?
Yeah, it wasn't in the amendment.
Conceptually amended. Okay. We need to make them, excuse me. Better have a, Representative Croft?
Yes, sir.
I need to clarify your, did you make an amendment to your amendment conceptually to delete the other section?
Yeah, I did.
I think we can conceptually, everybody will at the table will understand that a portion of the amendment is to delete the appeals section.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any further discussion? Senator French.
I'd like to hear from Mr. Woolover on this point about deleting the appeals commission, because we've talked about this a couple of times. I think there may be some alternatives out there to an appeals commission that would be inexpensive, and still provide the surety and the swiftness that some people ascribe to the Appeals Commission in Superior Court.
Mr. Wolver, or Mr. Lisicki?
Mr. Chairman, may I just offer one point of clarification? I know that Mr. Floersinger has some thoughts about this proposal, but what I haven't seen brought up adequately is it's not, inconsistency is not the only thing to be addressed, and I just want to put that on the table now rather than tag end it at the end after you get into discussion inconsistency. A major problem, in my view, is that there is no binding precedent being established short of a published opinion of the Alaska Supreme Court under the current provisions. And I don't think that this proposal addresses the lack of any binding precedent that can be generally applied to people to know if I'm in a similar situation to this other person that had a board decision that's published, will they do the same thing if I was to rely on that? Would they do something different? Same thing with the Superior Court. Their opinions are not binding precedent beyond the parties. So I just wanted to make that point to the committee before you follow up on the consistency question.
Is there a French question or response on that point?
On that point, maybe we can just clear this up forevermore. Are you conceding, Mr. Lisicki, that you've not been able to produce any evidence, hard evidence of inconsistent decisions from the panels and the board?
I didn't know that I was specifically required to do that, but no, I'm not conceding that, Senator.
I know I've asked in hearings, I asked over a year ago to be given, you know, two inconsistent decisions, either from the panel or from the Superior Court, and to date I've never seen one. I've never, ever been given decisions that in this instance say X and in this instance say Y.
Well, through the chair, Senator, that strikes me as unusual because I don't know how you could have 30 or 40 judges and all the panels that we do and have everybody agree all the time.
But that's as far as you're willing to go. It is that you imagine that there must be some inconsistent decisions out there.
I don't usually rely on my imagination for my testimony.
Okay, let's have Mr. Wolver come up to answer the direct question. If just one of you could step away.
Hello, for the record, my name is Doug Wolver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. And which question would you like me to answer?
The original. So would you restate your original question?
Actually, I just had a couple of questions about how an alternative system may work with respect to having some something besides an appeals commission, which goes straight to the Supreme Court. And I guess my question is this. Has anyone talked to the court system or explored with the court system assigning workers' comp cases either to a single judge or to a pool of, say, three judges? I know that when I raised the issue before of assigning workers' comp cases to a single judge, some people responded and say, well, you could always bump that judge. Everybody has a right to a peremptory challenge. You could challenge that judge and get right out of the assigned workers' comp judge. And I guess the comeback to that is you could pick a total of three. You could pick three Superior Court judges, say all appeals out of the workers' comp system go to those three Superior Court judges. And if you bump one, you get the second, and if the other party bumps the second, you get the third, and then you're done. There's no more bumps left, and you're going to have all workers' comp decisions decided by a very small pool of highly trained jurists who, after some time, would have seen many, many workers' comp cases because the grand total of them, I believe you told us in the past, is something like 30 per year. So each judge would maybe get 10 cases per year. After 2 years, they'd seen 20 workers' comp cases. They'd probably be getting pretty good at them. And we'd begin to develop the body of consistent law that individuals have told us is somehow lacking in the workers' comp system. Has anyone come to you and said this is an idea we'd like you to explore? Could you take that to the presiding judge?
Through the chair, Senator Hollis, no one has ever specifically asked the court to look into that. I have heard that as an option, but I haven't specifically raised it with the court to ask them to formally look at that. That's what they would do. They would go to the presiding judges and find out whether there's, you know, if there's a particular judge or group of judges in any given, in either within one district or spread out amongst the districts. It's something the court could look at, and I know is willing to look at, but we haven't been requested to do that so far.
And Can you comment on the efficacy of that idea? Would it work? Would it not work? 30 cases a year strikes me as being a fairly light caseload. I think you've told us in the past that the annual caseload for most Superior Court judges is something like 600. Is that right? It's the number that sticks in my mind.
Through the chair, that's how many open cases they would have at any given time, not necessarily new cases filed each year. I don't know whether that system would work. I imagine that it may work, and I know that the court would look at it if requested to do so.
Is that something perhaps the there's going to be a task force, if this bill ever becomes law, we'll have a task force that exists for a year. Perhaps that's something the task force could invite the presiding judge in, talk to the presiding judge, do it in front of the employers can be there, employees can be there, the unions can be there, the management can be there. We can talk about this idea of having all workers' comp appeals go to three Superior Court judges who are already on the state payroll.
Through the chair, Senator Hollis, we'd be more than happy to participate. What did I say, Senator Hollis?
Sorry, I'm going to start French. Laughing if you keep.
I probably said that several times, haven't I? Senator French, we'd be more than happy to answer any of those questions and address any of the issues that you know, the panel or this working group would come up with. And in fact, we'd be encourage you to invite us to discuss issues that might impact us, and that would be one of them, or could be.
Just a quick question that doesn't get around the issue of the Superior Court decisions are not published, not precedential. Is that correct?
That's true, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
So that issue is not dealt with at all.
So. On that point, you could ask them to publish them. They're mostly written decisions, and you could simply say, hey, why don't you guys publish your opinions? And I bet you they would. And the other thing is, it's not most people don't overrule themselves. And so if you had three individuals doing it over time, you would have a fairly consistent body of law. People see the same fact pattern and say, oh, I've decided this case before. That's easy. And away you go.
And would that be a consistent body of law until you had a new judge appointed to that task?
Just like it would be if you had an appeals commission or a Supreme Court overruling their decisions, because they're not judges, they're somebody else.
See, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't critique the last question because we're able to and afforded to ask any questions we want, but I think it's somewhat unfair to put Mr. Wolliver in the position where he has to answer precedentially under the measure of efficacy if you have an appeals provision in the bill versus what the amendment's proposing. Is there not better precedential value in the Superior Court? I mean, that's difficult for him as a court administrator and attorney to answer that. I know that his argument has been, hey, wait a minute, Supreme Court versus Superior Court, there's costs, there's factors that were compelling for me, but it's more compelling to reject the amendment and maintain that hearing dynamic. And we can agree to disagree, but without question, there's precedence from that I think is superior, pardon the pun, to the Superior Court. And I don't know how you wouldn't see that. Now, your three-judge idea is different, but I mean, when you're dealing with a divorce and a state and other things, and then you're dealing with a workers' comp claim, the precedential value of how the bill is currently recommending there be a hearing panel, I think, is better than, unless you're proposing an amendment to have three Superior Court judges or whatever Representative or Senator French was discussing.
Well,
let's see. We've got this amendment, which does not propose that.
Right.
So let's stick to this amendment at this point. Sure. Representative Roper?
To the chair, Mr. Wolliver, very briefly and off the top of your head, I mean, there seems to be some discussion about time frames and so forth. I know the judges are limited by how long they can hold on to a case because they won't get a paycheck. But it just seems to me, do you have any idea, in civil cases alone, how long it takes to go through the entire proceedings where a Superior Court judge would be writing an opinion in a civil case? How long does that process take, or do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, last year I looked into this question for workers' comp cases, and I believe that from the time you file with the Superior Court, including all the time for briefings and hearings and everything else, until the opinion is issued is something less than a year. It varies a bit. Some of them are 6 or 8 months. Others can be a year and a half, but they average something less than a year. In the Supreme Court, those same cases, and I looked at cases that were resolved at the Superior Court and then resolved again at the Supreme Court, they take about 20 months for that same, from the time you file through the briefings, oral arguments, and everything until an opinion is about 20 months.
Well, it seems to me there's been testimony that some 30 or 34 cases a year are appealed to the Superior Court level now. And therefore, we set this other system that would create a light caseload. It just, do you know if Superior Court judges are issuing opinions on civil cases at a rate of like one a week or less or more? I mean, I think that's kind of what I'm driving at. I don't know if you have any statistics or any even estimates of what a typical civil case is going to take per average. It seems to me that, I don't know if you dispose of, do judges get assigned more than one civil case a week on the dockets?
Through the chair, Representative Roker, we have statistics on that. I don't have them off the top of my head. How many we have? We have number of cases filed and dispositions, number of cases disposed of, and where they're disposed of in the process, whether there's a settlement an issue. I don't have any of that.
Do you have any idea how many written opinions are annually produced by Superior Court judges?
I don't. I'm sorry, Representative Roker.
We won't follow up with this, Mr. Chairman.
It's filibustering my amendment.
Representative Croft, I'm going to maintain my objection. I was actually during the Bar Convention approached by a Superior Court judge who said, please, take this. We don't do enough of them to develop any expertise. It's a specialized area of law. And so I'm going to maintain my objection. So do you have a wrap-up statement?
Wrap-up is this amendment will save us $1.5 million. And I've been searching for ways to fund some priorities in the capital budget. I'd appreciate the money. I'm also very worried about, I mean, it's all very nice to think that these political appointees who are going to be acting like judges might represent a philosophy that somebody would like better, but governors change, and you might not like philosophy of the next one or the next after that. I think it's a poor short-term decision that we're going to live to regret, and it's going to be an expensive one. So we can avoid this big mistake and use the current procedures to meet the objections, or we can launch ourselves into a very costly experiment.
And just a question, make sure I'm thinking of the right thing. This is the area, is it, where the administrative law judge selects the person who oversees this function and sits on every one of the appeals groups? So as far as them all being political appointees, there's a certain level of separation there where the person is appointed, can't be removed. I feel comfortable that that's mitigated somewhat, Senator French.
All right, that raised a thought I had earlier about this.
But then forget I said it then.
Yeah, the administrative law judge, where do those appeals go? Don't they go to Superior Court if you appeal the decision to the administrative law judge?
I believe.
Currently?
Yep.
Yes, they do.
But we're skipping that level here with the appeals commission.
I forgot.
Is there further questions? Seeing none, we will have a roll call vote on amendment number 5.
Representative Anderson?
Yes. Pardon me, restrike that. No.
Representative
That's right. That's true. Yes.
I'll leave you in.
No.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Tarrant? No. Okay, amendment number 5 fails. Representative Croft, do you have any other amendments? Representative Croft, any other amendments?
Do you want to go to the injury one, or you want to do any the conceptual ones I have before that? You have two left that you distributed.
Rather deal with your conceptual ones, or Senator French, do you have amendments to bring before?
I think mine was wrapped up in the one we just did.
Okay. Representative Croft.
Yeah, well, then the only one, and I apologize about not having it, is so it would be amendment number...
Number 6.
Number 6 is to...
Can be easily understood since we don't have it in writing.
Well, this is a very bright committee, I'm sure. Mortals couldn't understand it, but you guys can. To delete the provisions that freeze the doctor rates and instead freeze insurance rates for workers' compensation at last year's level, December 31st, 2004.
Okay. I'll object.
There's objection?
Can I speak?
You can speak to it.
Or you could do your objection first. Very briefly, and appreciate you letting me do it conceptually. I tried to dig into it. It was just too complicated, but I think they can write it. I don't like government setting the rates. So this is already an area that I'm uncomfortable with. I think it's never worked particularly well for these kind of rent control, price control things. Sometimes it's spectacularly been unsuccessful. Most of the time it's just moderately unsuccessful. It's almost nearly never successful. And it shows sort of an arrogance of government. But if we're going to embark on telling private individuals what they can charge for their services, I think it's much better to go to the actual root of this problem. We're stepping for the first time into, we set Medicaid and Medicare doctors' rates. And that, I think, was a mistake. I think it's led to a lot of doctors who don't take Medicaid or Medicare, and it's led to a lot of other sort of warping of the system. But at least we had the justification there that we were paying the bill. So you can have some sense of, well, we're only going to charge this much. To me, we're entering a brave new world here. We're stepping in and saying what a private employer and a private employee and a private physician can charge for a service. And where we get the gall to do that, I don't know. I mean, I ordered a book on Amazon on the history of price control, and just the blurb was talking about the communist attempts to do this to meet the food crises in 1918 to 21, and Mao Zedong doing it, and just it never has worked.
Don't forget Richard Nixon.
Nixon, and it didn't, and they got rid of that too. That put in the sort of moderate failure, and some of these others in the Russian famine of 1919 was caused by these price control, people dying.
Mr. Chair, to the Russian.
I find really offensive even this. We're going to solve this by telling private doctors what they can charge. And want to substitute it here with, to me, a less objectionable form of this intrusion into the marketplace, which it says, we have a crisis in insurance rates, or at least a difficulty and maybe a crisis. Let's freeze the rates for a period of time and try and get to some of these problems. And I think I worry that if you leave this provision on doctors' rates in, you're never going to get it out. That somebody's going to say next year or the year after or 5 or 10 years from now, when there's another crisis in workers' compensation insurance, well, it's easy now. We've already set the precedent. We set the doctors' rates. What if we rolled them back 5% or 10%? That'll solve it this year, and then next year it's, well, we got to do 15 this year. I've talked to the doctors' groups about this being as dangerous an intrusion of government into private affairs as sort of I've seen. So I'd much rather replace it with something that freezes the direct problem as we work towards a solution.
Senator, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly, and I guess I'll ask Paul. I don't know if he can... if he can answer it adequately or not in his position, but it's my speculation that if we freeze physician rates and medical rates at a reasonable level, the presumption is that those physicians won't vacate and move out of state. And I know, again, this is another hypothetical, but do you think that there is a larger potential for, or greater potential for, if we freeze insurance rates, that they could leave? And do you have any knowledge or history of that in other states where a certain rate is given and an insurance company says, hey, especially in Alaska, I'll just leave?
Representative Anderson, through the chair, I don't have any personal knowledge of it. All I know is what I've heard in the way of testimony from the Division of Insurance.
And what would that be, through the chair?
I think that they had, through the chair, Representative Anderson, they did have grave concerns about maintaining a market.
An insurance market?
Yes.
Is there further discussion on Amendment Number 6, Senator French?
I guess I would just add a conceptual addition to the amendment to be that the insurance rates can be no higher than what they are. They can certainly go down. We don't want to freeze them at these exorbitantly high rates. And I guess I'm thinking back to a chart that was given us in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee when we were discussing, or Senate Judiciary Committee when we were discussing this bill earlier this year. I asked for a chart of, what workers' comp insurance rates had done over the years. And what I got back was something that looked you'll have to forgive me, but something like this, and I've shown it to Senator Huggins earlier, and it basically shows that 1992 rates were just about as high as they are now. And so the idea that we've got these astonishingly high rates may be true, but as a matter of fact, they were just as high back in 1992, so it's not as if they're higher than they've ever been in the history of the world.
Is that adjusted for inflation?
I think it's adjusted for inflation. And what we had was this great decade of declining rates when there was intense competition, I think some predatory pricing going on in the market, and the rates got driven down, high stock market returns, as we all understand.
Legislature stepped in and reformed the system.
Well, the point, of course, is that we don't want to freeze rates the way they are at this high point. We want to let them drift back down, because chances are they're going to do that. They're cyclical, like a lot of things are. And so I think what we're seeing is sort of a snapshot in time when the rates have been unusually high as a matter of history, but probably going to go back down. So I just want to make sure that we don't freeze them in place at a high place. We say that we've set a ceiling on them, and that if all other things cooperate, the other reforms envisioned in the bill work the way they're intended to work, that we'll let insurance rates drift back down in the future. So that's an amendment to the amendment.
There's an amendment to amendment number 6 that would basically say we're not going to freeze them high and not let them move down. Is there any objection? The amendment to the amendment?
Objection to the amendment to the amendment?
Sure, never make a bad bill better.
What was the amendment?
It's a bad amendment.
I didn't hear what the amendment to the amendment.
Right, don't make a bad bill better, exactly.
The amendment to the amendment is to just, that Senator French has offered, is that the rates would not be frozen and not allowed.
I'll remove my objection.
There's no objection to the amendment. To the amendment has been removed. The amendment to the amendment passes, brings us back to amendment number 6. Representative Croft, any wrap-up?
Norm can wrap up for me.
Mr. Chairman, I just not sure what happened. It just, my concern here is the situation for availability of insurance and workers' comp insurance in the state. We only have 3 primary underwriters right now. This speaks to their solvency, and it speaks to the availability of insurance here, so I find this entirely objectionable. Thank you.
We'll have a roll call vote on amendment number 6.
Yes.
Representative
Roper?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Terry?
No. Amendment number 6 fails. I will at this time move R.1 as amendment number 7.
I'll be.
Okay, R.1. Deals with the definition of injury section. You can see on page 2.
So this is number 6 or 7?
It's
R1. Yeah. R.1 will number
7.
Amendment number 7. And this is where we are dealing with the issue that came up on the House floor debate over whether the wording, current wording on the bill created a, in its definition of injury, created a separate tort action of possible claims that were outside of the coverage of workers' comp. We have clarified, we're going to take out the language that tries to deal with by just modifying the definition of injury, and we created this B and C section. So from my understanding of the argument that was made on the floor, that if in fact the bill had the possibility of creating that separate tort action, then our current statutes also had language that could potentially create that separate tort action under that particular interpretation with regard to mental stress. And so this amendment has been drafted to deal with the mental stress is the C section there on page 1, and the B section talks about the the major contributing cause, taking that out and defining that if you have an action that's not the major contributing cause, it doesn't open up separate action for tort. Let's see. So there was the tort issue, and then there's the policy call on the major contributing cause limitation. Representative Anderson.
I think I'm going to add to what you're saying, clarify for the members. So what we've done in that amendment, if you pass the amendment, you delete the exclusions for pre-existing and mental injuries from this 2330.395.17 on page 45 of the bill, and then we're placing them in a consolidated area under a covered section 2330.010. And the presumption there is, or the hope is that it will limit or actually reduce any, eliminate any chance for tort claims and keep those definitions properly under one area so that they all fall under workers' comp. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Mr. Lozinski, do you have any comments on this section?
I can speak to that, Mr. Chairman. The idea here was to basically take these definitions, take it out of the definition of injury. Injury is used around the Act in various places. But take them out of the definition of injury and put it more as a limitation of benefits available under the Act rather than a limitation of the term injury that is used in throughout the Act.
Representative Croft.
Yeah. I think you're trying to do the wrong thing better in this amendment, and so I appreciate that. I don't know whether you can still constitutionally do it. I've seen cases saying you got to have some sort of remedy for when something happens. So let me understand with the new amendment what we're achieving. Somebody with a pre-existing injury, neck injury, comes and re-injures their neck on the job. Using my friend Harry Crawford, he had a sledgehammer dropped on him once and hit his neck, and if he's unlucky enough to have that happen again, they're out. It's definitely work-related, definitely within the scope of employment, and they're definitely injured. What do they do? If it doesn't qualify, if it's not the major, it's a substantial factor in it. You had the old injury and you got this new one. Where do they recover anything? What do they do with their lives?
Go first, or by me?
All right.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, the injury, the sledgehammer injury, would be paid for by the second employer, as would any kind of injury on the job. The issue that would arise is somewhere down the line, perhaps at medical stability, something like that, the question would come up, does the ongoing need for disability or medical benefits, is this dropping of this hammer the major contributing cause of that need? And in that situation, it would basically be presented first to physicians for testimony and then to the board. They would be asked the question, doctor, in your opinion, did the drop of the hammer, is that the major contributing cause, or is this pre-existing condition the major contributing cause? In the event that it is, that second employer continues to pay. Under our existing act, if the first injury was an injury with an employer, then the second employer could continue to pay and turn around and go back to the first employer and seek reimbursement. That's already in the existing law.
So the second employer would, even under this amendment, go after the first employer?
It could, yes.
If it is a substantial factor but not the major contributing cause, this amendment says compensation and benefits are not payable. So the doctors say, well, he had a previous injury. That's an important part of this. The sledgehammer clone was clearly asubstantial. But if they find in the mix of factors, it ain't 51, it was 40% of the cause. But they are clearly injured. They were clearly injured on the job, and they're clearly disabled by it. Who pays under this amendment? What do they get? If no compensation or benefits are payable under this chapter, they sit at home and what?
Well,
the situation you would have is you would come to the board, you could say, look, I can't work. I need more medical benefits. And an employer would say, we are not the major contributing cause. In fact, we're going to point to a different cause, a separate cause. And we're pointing to that earlier injury. And in that kind of a situation, I think it's 155, and our court's addressed it. Our court has said, when the only dispute over benefits is between two insurers, 2330-155D requires the most recent insurer to pay the benefits to which the worker is entitled until a final determination is made regarding the extent of liability of each insurer. Now, ultimately, that second insurer may be able to prove that no benefits are due and payable. And they may be able to prove that, in fact, they didn't owe a portion or a period of benefits and can get reimbursement from that first employer. But if they determine that that first employer is the major contributing cause, that first employer could be on the hook. And it's an issue of fairness as between these two.
It's an issue of fairness between the two insurance providers. Is that correct?
Between the two insurers, correct. That's the term the court used, but I think it's the statute actually uses employers or insurers. I'm not positive.
Well, employers or their insurance coverage. See, I have Representative Anderson and then Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was on May 15th, the Department of Law Civil Division tried to answer some of these questions, and if I may read part of it in the record because it's very much appropriate or applicable to this. The question was posed, employees' right to workers' compensation benefits. Under current law, if an employee suffers a work-related injury at employer one and later suffers a related injury at employer two, will the employee receive workers' compensation benefits? Will the employee, not talking about employers or insurance companies, the answer is yes. Under this bill, if we pass this bill with the amendment, if an employee suffers a work-related injury at employer one and later suffers a related injury at employer two, will the employee receive workers' compensation benefits? Yes. So I think that's critical in the analysis. At least we know, at minimum, that the employee is going to be covered. He's out playing softball. That brings in a different contingent, a different circumstance. But if it's employer to the next employer, there's coverage. But then the next thing, and I think this is good to read into the record, under the category in this memo, employer's duty to pay workers' compensation benefits, under the current law, it reads, if an employee suffers a work-related injury at employer one and later suffers a related injury at employer two, which employer pays the workers' compensation benefits, well, it would be employer two. And if the injury for which compensation is sought is aggravated, accelerated, or combined with the first injury and is substantial, that's the substantial factor. But under this bill, if the same scenario occurs, employer two will pay if the injury for which compensation is sought, aggravated, accelerated, or combined, is the major contributing cause. And I think that's obviously the difference, but I don't know if that answered Representative Croft's question or not. And then employer one and employer two are disputing as they go through this dispute who is responsible under either standard, employer two.
So just, Representative Crofts, it seems like the concern you're stating is that with this amendment, whether the second employer where a pre-existing injury is aggravated escapes any coverage and the worker's left with nothing. And Mr. Lozinski, that's not the intent of the division. Correct?
In the scenario that you're talking about where it's a prior work injury followed by a second work injury, it would be as described by Mr. Floor Center.
And Senator French.
And what if there's no first insurer? What if it's not a workplace injury? What if it's a sports injury or a home injury or a pre-existing condition? Or the company that you work for went belly up years ago and dissipated their assets. There's no first insurer, then what? And your workplace injury is a substantial factor, but not a major contributing cause of your disability. Then what?
Senator French, through the chair, that's the scenario that brings up now. If you get hurt at home and you go to work and you do something that's not even a substantial factor and you wanted workers' compensation, you'd get nothing.
Right.
So this would just take it up to the next step.
It raises the bar.
It raises the bar.
You pay for your claims.
You pay fewer claims for people whose predominant reason that they're injured is because they were hurt at home.
Well, except for now, we pay it if and only, it has to be a substantial factor. It can't be an insubstantial factor, a small factor, a little factor. It's got to be a substantial factor.
That's correct.
We've been working under that standard since at least 1980. That's the first court case I can see that erected that standard, and probably before, I don't know. But
through the chair, Senator French, I believe you're right that it came up through court interpretations.
So it's a nearly a 30-year doctrine of substantial factor that we're just going to raise the bar a little bit so we let a few injured workers go home with nothing.
Or through the chair, or let a few employers not pay for an injury that was predominantly caused at the worker's home.
It's that bar, you know. If you put zero at the bottom and 100% at the top, I don't know what substantial factor is, but I'm guessing, let's say it's 35%.
It's less than that, through the chair, but I
say it's 25%. And let's say major contributing cause, that's got to be 51, right? I mean, major, it's more, you know, if
the major cause, I think in most cases it would be.
So anyone between 25 and 51, that's 26%. If you fall in that range, sorry, not covered. I mean, I want to make sure I know what policy decision I'm making so I can articulate it to my constituents in case they come to me and say, what'd you guys do down there? I can say, well, let me tell you this. If your workplace injury under this new law was more than 26, but less than 51% of what caused your disability, I hope you've got some money saved up, because the workers' comp system is leaving you high and dry.
Or through the chair, or your health insurer perhaps would pay it as they would have originally.
So, Representative Roper.
Oh, just to help clear up the, I think, the references of the administration to the current law, 2330055D, just to read that in part, when payment of temporary disability benefits is converted solely on the grounds that another employer or another insurer of the same employer may be responsible for all or a portion of the benefits, the most recent employer or insurer is party to the claim and who may be liable shall make the payments during dependency of the dispute. So there's never a problem with it being covered when there's an employment in one or two or more employers. And then the issue then becomes whoever is the prevailing employer in any cause of action to litigate the differential. So the employer is always covered. I think the situation that you've just been discussing, Senator French, speaks to the non-work-related injury issue in the standard here. So I think you're correct in saying that a substantial factor is the case law in the state, and we're trying to statutorily raise it to a major contributing cause. But the functioning and the coverage of an employer, an insurer, an employee doesn't really change. We're just raising the standard, as I understand it. But then we get into this discussion that Senator French raises about what happens if. I mean, that's, as I understand it, one of the major problems of the state right now is the non-work-related injury and how that fits into the allocation of causal factors and awards. Because if I might ask Mr. Florsinger, we have this doctrine of the last employer. What do you call that?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, it's basically the last injurious exposure doctrine.
The last injurious exposure doctrine?
Correct.
So the guy he's working for now gets stuck with the whole bill, whether it's right or wrong. I mean, that's what we're speaking to here. So in certain discussions about what we want to avoid allocations and so forth, but that's kind of the horns of the dilemma we're on here.
And the examples that before the meeting started today ran through a couple examples. But if I have a pre-existing condition, either from previous employment or football injury, that I've got an arthritic knee, but then at work I bang my knee, and now, you know, my knee used to act up a little bit, but now I can't stand up. Will there be coverage to put me back to the point of the minute before I banged my knee? will workers' comp step in to put me back to that point, but not necessarily have to now replace my knee?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's what Mr. Floorsinger was getting to when he said that, used the example with the hammer strike.
Okay. So the concern that now I bang my knee and I can't stand up, but I had a pre-existing arthritic knee, so I'm going to get nothing, is not correct.
If your banged knee is the major contributing cause of your ongoing disability or medical benefits, you know, I think about how this might play out in a case, and you have a doctor sitting there, you're working, you have an arthritic knee, you bang your knee, and now you can't stand up. I can't imagine a doctor saying, no, that banged knee wasn't a major contributing cause. Look at the difference. He was working. It hurt him a little bit. Now he can't stand up. The kind of cases these come into play, and you you see this occur, are the kinds of cases like carpal tunnel. And it's been litigated where you get 3, 4, 5 employers in a situation. And one employer may have 2 weeks of employment. And one employer may have 5 years of employment. And then you get, maybe the 2 weeks is the one on the end. And you have to sit there and, as a the last employer, argue, well, I'm not a substantial factor. The difficulty you have is if that five-year employer can say you're a substantial factor, the guy that employed him for 2 weeks picks up the whole tab. Those are the kind of cases you see. In this, under this, if you're not the major contributing factor, perhaps that 5 years of running a power wrench is the cause, the major contributing factor, that employer, the responsible employer, the employer that injured the employee, is the employer that have to pick up the benefits.
All the benefits or portion of them?
Well, the employer will have to pick up the medical and disability benefits. I would say once that second employer proves it's not a major contributing cause, that first employer has to pick up the benefits. Yes.
Representative Croft.
Yeah, it was just, thank you, on that particular example. You know, if somebody's gone through a number of different employments where it's all contributing to something that is clearly a medical problem, but it's hard to identify carpal tunnel or wherever, that all the repeated work they did contributed to it, but it's hard to identify. Can't you have a situation where nobody is the primary? I mean, if you work for 4 years for 3 or 4 different employers in a row, each one was a substantial factor going towards it, but nobody rises to 51%. You got 4 years and 4 years and 4 years. Courts say it was about a third each, and a third is not the predominant fact. So I don't get paid by the one or the other or the other. Everybody gets out on this provision because they say, I wasn't 51%, yet I know I have a work-related condition and that my work caused it, and I know I have a medical problem. If I have to prove somebody 51, how do you ever get any recovery for that kind of a situation?
Well, somebody may be 51 when you have 2, when you have 3, 4, 5 maybe. It's not a 51. It's, you basically, how this works in practice is you lay it out in front of a doctor and you say, look, here's the medical on this injury, here's the medical on this injury, here's the medical on this. Pick the major contributing cause to this, and the doctor will pick one. I'm not quite sure where this 51% kind of fits into our analysis, except I guess if you had 3, the one that's 34 would be the one.
You mean you
the
think
major contributing cause?
You think predominant means compared to all the others, or predominant in a sort of absolute sense? Because I haven't read any case law that supports that. I think the analogy you gave, you could have a number of people who are substantial factors contributing towards, but nobody the predominant, and that person would not receive recovery. If you mean more than other people,
are you talking? I'm sorry, excuse me.
Yeah, if you mean predominant to mean more than a lot of others who are in this room, being sued, then it could be 5% and everyone else is 4. If you want to put that on the record, that, I mean, that's fine, but I don't believe that's the way this statute should be read.
What I was, through the chair, Representative Croft, what I was trying to point out is I don't know that you necessarily would apply percentages at all. I think what you would be doing in practice is sitting down in front of a physician with the medical records, maybe have 2 or 3 injuries, and then by a preponderance of the evidence, which injury was the major contributing cause.
And on your analogy, I can very easily see a doctor sitting there saying, I know that working for 4 years keyboarding was a substantial factor in getting this injury that they clearly have. I know that the next employment was a substantial factor, but no, I cannot. I'm on the stand, I'm sworn in. I cannot say that 4 years as opposed to this 4 years was the predominant factor. And you could have somebody clearly with an injury that you never rise to this level with anybody. And in fact, isn't this the point? I mean, isn't that the point of this provision? The reason it saves money is that kind of situation. It saves money when you get somebody who's clearly injured, it's clearly on the workplace, so it would have been recoverable, but we're going to get them out for this technical reason. We're going to get them out of coverage and save rates because of it.
It could also be termed as we're going to find the employer most responsible for this disability and medical.
No, that prior employer, isn't it often the case that they've settled that prior claim? I mean, you hurt your neck, you get to stable, it is a certain amount of disabling, hopefully not much, you get to a 5 or 10% rating, you settle it, you want them back to work, they're at work, they re-injure it. It's a combination of the new and the old. But if you've settled your claim, there's nothing left. You the employer's off the hook and the employee can't go back for more.
From the disability standpoint, I think that'd be correct. From the medical, generally medical is not settled.
I'm at home. If I've left my medical open, great. I'm at home. I'll get my medical bills paid, but I don't get any compensation because it's a combination of two injuries.
And I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, we keep talking, but I appreciate it. My current injury, the old injury put me at a 5%. So I settled that claim, left the medicals open. Great, I'm chugging along. The new injury doubled it or did it worse. I mean, the problem with this system is you can have a substantial injury where it falls through that crack between substantial factor and predominant. Is it predominant? Yeah.
Major contributing cause?
Major contributing cause.
But predominant is a measure that you're instilling.
What I would say is that in the situation where you have the previously settled claim, that employee, except for the medical aspect, is similar to a pre-existing condition that happened in gardening. That employee has been paid for that first injury is the only difference.
Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Thanks. Real quick, I don't want to get into the philosophy because Representative Croft and I have spoken about this before and even today that there's some passion, not some passion, there's a lot of passion and conviction, and it's not about employee versus employer, because I hope it isn't. I mean, if someone's injured, you want to make sure that they're fairly treated, but not at the expense of an employer. And I mean, this debate has been going on since last legislature as well, so I won't get into that. But I don't think the motive is to burn someone's benefits as a result of this amendment. But my concern is, I applaud the amendment in many realms except this. I've heard from the physician community that specifically on the first page, line 9, where it states, as Representative Croft just stated, major contributing causes. What is major? What's the definition? Who decides it? Is there right of an appeal? And I think that you did bring up a very good point. You talked about the different, yeah, you did, in terms of what percentage, even if it's not 51%, how is it that a physician or medical provider can truly determine that? And in the process, who determines it? Is it an insurance clerk? Or it sounds like you've testified that it is a physician. But I've received several calls over the last 2 days that that could be the deal breaker for physician support for this amendment, not because of employer or employee. I mean, there's got to be fairness. And I don't want to get into the sports accident and you expect an employer, give me a break to cover that. But I'm talking about major contributing causes. Is there a way you can reconcile that for the physician who's concerned about those?
Well,
it's hard for me
Chair,
to support.
Representative Anderson, I thought about that quite a bit as well. And what I looked at not too long ago was a follow-up study that the state of Oregon did after they adopted the major cause standard. And part of their study was a they did some polling of the physician community in Oregon. And I don't have it in front of me, so I may not be as precise as I'd like to be. But my impression was that the physician community in Oregon said it was a workable standard, but it took some education of the physicians involved in the process to get a comfort level with it.
So, well, then I would ask, once you're done with questions, for an at ease, and I'd like to talk to Mr. Lisinski about some of this.
Okay. Chair. Do we have any other major questions on the
major
wording of the amendment?
I just,
Representative Roper.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I just would like to go back to this issue of under current law. If they're all work-related type injuries, no matter how many, the worker receives benefits. Is that a fair statement? I mean, there's no avoidance by substantial factor or whatever tests we have currently. Somebody's paying the bill even after the insurance companies sue each other. The employee is covered.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Right. What happens now under current law if we have a non-work-related, say, sports injury that is in this series of problems that occur medically to a person? How is that handled currently by the board? Do they even apportion some responsibility to a subsequent injury from a pre-existing condition that's non-work-related, or how they do that?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, the court has been pretty clear on that. And they say that unless the work is not even a substantial cause, a substantial factor, then the employment bears the entire responsibility for the disability and medical care.
So, but excuse me, I'm not sure I heard that. If there's a non-work related pre-existing condition, and is it just a substantial factor? Maybe if we use Senator French's 24% or 26% or whatever the cut line is, does that mean the employer is going to be on the hook for that entire benefit?
Through the chair, Representative Rookberg, based on my recollection of the court cases, yes, they get it all.
But how would this particular amendment solve that? I mean, would that solve that particular in type of fact pattern? Because the major contributing cause would have to be the work-related injury, not the non-work-related injury, though. So that would solve that, wouldn't it?
Through the chair, that would be the difference. I believe that's what.
Well, that's one of the goals of this amendment. But does it work in the converse? I mean, I have some questions about that.
You got to keep that. I'll rip it.
Because what about that worker that it has somewhat less impairment than, say, whatever percentage, but then you have to, it's the distinction between the substantial factor and the major contributing cause seem to be some judgment out there. And I guess I'm babbling on here, forgive me, Mr. Chairman, we're all getting tired, but as a matter of policy, does the board ever apportion what they believe to be a percentage of liability in any kind of adjudication?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, no, there is no provision for any apportionment under Alaska law.
And why don't we do that?
I can't give, through the chair, Representative Roper, I can't give you a definitive answer, but most of the thinking that I've seen on it is that it can be a very grueling experience to try and parse out with precision percentages of liability, and the court has shied away from it. I believe there was a court case that mentioned that there were some places that tried to do that, but they were unwilling to begin that in Alaska because they thought it was
going to be very litigious.
Thank you, Chairman.
And so Oregon has had this similar language in place for how long?
I believe it was first adopted around 1990, and then there was some more amendment of that around 1995, I think.
Mr. Chairman, did Oregon do their entire rewrite of their whole body of law, or did they do it in a piecemeal fashion?
Through the chair, as you might expect, Representative Rookberg, they've been at it a piece here and a piece there for a significant period of time.
Representative
Yeah, on Oregon.
Croft,
so you modeled this provision as well on the Oregon law?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I don't know that if this particular provision is not necessarily.
Oregon has the idea of the major contributing cause, and that's what you put into our law here.
Through the chair, I think that would be correct.
In Oregon, when something is a substantial factor but not the major contributing cause and therefore not covered by comp, can somebody sue in tort liability the individual employer?
There was, my understanding is, there was a case based on a particular provision in Oregon's constitution. I don't pretend to be entirely up to speed on that, but it is my understanding that we do not have a similar provision in the Alaska Constitution.
Okay, but so in Oregon, if it's only a, whatever, 20% to 30%, if it's a substantial factor but not the major contributing, they can sue the employer in tort.
I'm not comfortable saying that because I'm not that up to speed on what they have done on the constitutional provisions in Oregon.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'd like to take a break at this time. Say, why don't we break for an hour? Representative Anderson?
We're almost done, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so
7:15?
We come back at 7:15 and allow people to have conversations that they want and also to get a quick bite to eat. So we'll recess until 7:15. Meeting would come back to order. Before we broke, we had amendment number 7 pending before us. Based on the conversation that took place before we broke, I have drafted amendment to amendment number 7. That's the R.23 piece of paper. And so at this time, I'd like to move amendment to amendment number 7. And just for purposes of clarifying, it seemed like there's the current language of amendment number 7 is somewhat subjective to the interpretation that if it's not the major contributor cause, you know, that there's no coverage. But up above, when you look at the A section, it says, except as provided in B and C of this section. And the B section talks about aggravation, acceleration, or combination with a pre-existing condition. So I wanted to try and clarify that the B limitation is only those things where it's, you know, an aggravation. It's not a new injury, or if in the aggravation, acceleration, there is in fact a new injury. You bump the arthritic knee, and in doing so, there's a new gash or something that is going to be covered by the second employer. And then, Mr. Lazinski, if you'd like to talk to the lines 6 through 9 of the amendment to the amendment, it's, again, to try and bring further clarification to the B section. Or Mr. Florschinger would.
Perhaps I can. Mr. Chairman, 7 through 9. Is essentially some language taken from an Oregon case where they were attempting to define major contributing cause. Their statute doesn't quite work the same way as ours. We always talk of cause as cause of disability or need for medical benefits. But a portion of that language
was taken and then drafted such that it does relate to our statute in those terms, causation of disability or death of an employee or an employee's need for medical treatment, and then uses the term primary cause.
Okay, do we have questions to on the amendment to the amendment? Is the objection to the amendment maintained? And seeing none, the amendment to the amendment is passed. Brings us back to amendment number 7. Is there further discussion on amendment number 7? Is there objection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rookberg, I have obviously over the last few hours talked to with a lot of people, and I'm not supportive of it at this time because I think that I hate saying that we need to study it more, because that's a lot of times that's just a subterfuge to delay things. But in this case, I've talked to too many folks from the medical community who feel that there's not enough empirical evidence to show that it works to benefit not only in the healthcare aspect but for the employee. Some different things were given to me today. I wish I would have had them last month, like Senator Seekins had them. But things that talked about issues like in Oregon, where a lot of people, even I earlier, was bragging about that we're using this bill and copying Oregon. And I respect that we have taken and extracted a lot of things from Oregon's statutes. But with respect to the comment made that, hey, Oregon has had a study and there's physician comments, apparently they only wrote to 35 doctors. I mean, I would assume there's many thousands of doctors in Oregon, and only 11 responded. And I mean, it's just not compelling for me to that end. And then the other concern I had was that with respect to, I think there's an incredible onus on the physician right now, and with fraud aspects of the bill and the goal of trying to get workers back to work, and again, not putting it on the back of the employer, but not being sure personally how this would work. I would rather see this go to this medical review committee, and then at the end, maybe even draft language. Representative Roper was talking, I was bringing this up with him earlier, adding that to one of their directives to bring back to us at the end of the year. I know some members don't support that and really want to see this in the bill, and I respectfully bow my head and say sorry, but I just, at this time, I can't support it. So, but Representative Rookberg signaled me that, is there a way, because I think that I'm...
Right, we need to do something here that, I just about got this done.
Mr. Chair, if we 3-3, if the amendment fails, there's one portion that has to be, is it reinserted or deleted, Representative?
Yeah, here it is.
B section.
Yeah, and then it's conceptually.
Okay, so I'm gonna. So Representative Roper can assist me on this. But whatever he says is from me. So
it's an amendment to amendment.
Okay, so that's first. I can read your writing. So this is an amendment to the amendment, and it would delete page 1, line 1 to line 20, and line 22 and 23.
No, that's okay.
That one's okay.
Okay. It would delete page 1, line 1 to line 20, and it would delete page 2 and 3. Renumber accordingly, and this one, and he's writing that the concept should be sent through the medical committee, the medical review committee, to the task force, meaning
actually,
have
that's
them
right.
Look at this.
Yeah, no.
Now, this Representative is really Roper, conceptual.
Yeah, let me
brief it here. Yeah.
Let me just ask you, are you just the C section, the issue with the secondary tort issue? The C section fixes that. That's a problem that exists. If such a problem exists, the C section fixes that in our current statutes.
Oh, okay, that's right. Forgive me.
So I would have to
Representative Rookberg, are you just trying to delete the B section?
It's the B section, right, and insert that into the task force. I think that's what Representative Anderson wanted to do. That's right, forgive me, I screwed that up. Then we'd still delete the other things and then conform it as necessary, but yeah, it would just be the B section.
Okay, well, I think that's understandable by itself. Let me just see if I can phrase it correctly. You would like to, with the major contributing cost section, delete that from the bill.
Right. And then conform it to...
And have that referred to the commission?
The task force.
The task force.
Page 1, line 7 through 10 of Amendment 7.
Right.
Which is subsection B of 2330.010.
Okay. Well, I think that's understandable conceptually. I'm going to object to that. There would be some, obviously, some conforming up above.
Take
out the C, and the C would now become B. But I think everybody can understand that the B section, which deals with the major contributing cause, is being proposed to come out.
The deletion there.
Go to the task force.
Stays in.
Can I ask a question to the maker of the amendment?
Senator French?
If the intention is to remove major contributing cause, there's also a definition section on page 46 of the bill that uses the exact same language. And I'm just wondering whether you intend to maintain the workers' comp laws under the standard they've operated under for 25 years, the substantial factor, or whether we're splitting the baby or what we're doing.
No intention to split. We should be conforming.
Yeah.
As a conceptual.
Conceptual amendment would also remove the definition on lines 3, 4, yeah. 5, 6 of page 46.
Well, it's here. It's page 46, lines 3 through 13.
Right.
No.
Right?
No, I think 3 through 13 is over here.
Yeah.
That says delete down here, so we're leaving that in.
Yeah, so we're leaving that section through the chair. We're leaving that in, Senator French, so that it's deleted.
Oh, I see.
I see, yep.
Well, I'm getting tired.
Okay,
that's good,
well,
it says delete.
I'm going to maintain my objection. Do either you want to
share this is the best way, I think, to preserve part of the amendment, obviously,
right.
Versus just killing it and then bringing a new amendment. So I hope the minority members understand that.
Are there further questions on what is amendment? The second amendment to the amendment, and that being amendment number 7. Further debate? I'll call the roll call.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
No. The amendment to the amendment fails, lacking the 2 votes from the Senate side. Brings the amendment back before us, amendment number 7, as amended. Is there further objection to amendment number 7?
There's objection to amendment number 7 because we failed to amend it. It's back in its
current.
It has its current, cleaned up a little by your amendment to the amendment, but it currently would...
Include the B section. That's correct. Okay, there is objection. Is there any discussion? Have a roll call vote.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Croft?
No.
Representative Roper?
Yes.
Senator Huggins?
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Senator Tyrion?
Yes. The amendment fails, lacking 2 votes on the House side. Point we'll go on. We've got a couple of technical amendments. Mr. Bullock, do you want to come forward or to explain? I believe these are just drafting issues. Is that correct? If you like to speak to these amendment number 8. At this time, I will offer amendment number 8.
Object.
There's an objection.
Which one did you do?
It is the R.24.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Don Bullock. I'm an attorney with Legal Services. There is a redundant situation in the bill that this amendment corrects. It has to do with the initial appointments to the members of the Appeals Commission. And it was codified in on page 7, line 30, and on the following page as to the terms for each of the members following the initial appointment. So this clarifies by inserting initially to clarify that the terms are for the initial appointments. And then what's deleted on page 50, lines 22 to 29, is another section that dealt with the same issue, which was making the initial appointment so that the terms of the members would be staggered.
Okay, so the word initially has to be set in there because that's when you're first setting up the rotation. And some people get a 1 year, 2 year, and that needed to be clarified.
Yes.
So is there objection to amendment number 8? Representative Croft.
I understand the first part, and that sounds fine. You'd have a silly sort of 4 year, 3 year, 2 year, 1 year term form. What is the line 52 conforming amendments, or page 52 stuff doing?
On page 50, lines 22 to 29 removes a section of the bill and requires renumbering the other sections.
Okay, yeah. Then that sounds fine. I don't have any objection.
There's no objection then. Amendment number 8 is adopted. Amendment number 9, I will move at this time. Mr. Bullock.
Amendment number 9 deals with a subject that you discussed earlier. And on page 16, or actually pages 15 and 16 of the bill, this is where the discussion was about the form that an employee files electing one option or another. And this amendment changes the language in the latter part of section 18 of the bill so that it reads consistently with the earlier change that you adopted. Because earlier we changed it to say that the form prescribed by the board and so forth would be filed with the board, and the board would distribute it. And this changes the language later from "the administrator shall serve a copy of the executed election," and changes it to say "the board shall serve a copy of the executed election." It just gives a responsibility to serve it to the party that has it in their hands.
Is there objection to amendment number 9? Representative Croft.
Just a quick question. So before it said "the administrator shall serve on the parties," meaning employer and employee. And then we say "the board shall serve on the administrator," and I guess I expect to see parties there. Why is it just employer there?
One party signed the execution.
We need to serve it back on them. Okay.
Any further objection? Amendment number 9 is adopted.
Any other questions before I stand down? Any other questions before I stand down?
Don't believe so. Questions for Mr. Bullock?
Thanks for your hard work. Thank you.
At this point, I'd like to take a brief at ease.
Thanks.